You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 3rd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Maya Shenhwar. Locked down and locked out. Why prisons don't work. Also on the program today, another fast food strike planned for tomorrow. In the 2 years since the fight for $15 hour wages at fast food restaurants, we have seen actual raising of the minimum wage across the country. Also on today's program, an important court case in New Jersey regarding transgender vets could allow for over 100,000 transgender vets to get the services they have earned via their service in our armed forces. Also on the program today, government shutdown averted for the moment as the Republicans seem to be wilting in the face of a more robust President Obama. And perhaps the single most, how do I express this? I don't know that I've ever been more ambivalent about a story in my entire career involving Social Security and Nazis. All that and more on today's program. So rare to see those two things collide, but they have. We will get to that later in the program. Hey, just a reminder, folks, it is your memberships that make this show possible. You can become a member today at majority.fm or jointhemajorityreport.com. Just pennies a day, folks, and you make this show possible. Also, another reminder, justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate makes a great Hanukkah gift. I think you can get some by Hanukkah. Yes, definitely. And certainly a great Christmas gift. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's a fair trade. Everybody who's involved in the production of that coffee, it gets a fair wage. And on top of it, it's a co-op-owned company. That is a triple win. Maybe a quadruple win. We haven't done the math. We've got to get someone who knows how to work spreadsheets in this office.
The environment, too.
What's that?
The environment, too.
Okay.
It's so definitely it's a quadruple win.
Maybe it's a quintuplet win. You got to get just learn how to do a Google spreadsheet, for God's sakes.
I could do that without a Google spreadsheet. Well, be a little faster on your
maybe
feet
we're
there.
Some on the table.
Great, 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 great,
also,
great grandpa.
if you happen to purchase stuff from Amazon, by all means, the least you can do is to use our link so that we get a kickback. People use Amazon. And if you do use Amazon, not exactly the greatest labor practices, that's for sure. But if you do use them, the least you can do is to kick back some money so that we can continue to criticize their labor practices on their dime. Simply go to majorityreportkickback.com, majorityreportkickback.com. You click on the link, you bookmark it. Every time you use Amazon, we get a kickback. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Maya Shenhua on her book, Locked Down and Locked Out. All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Maya Shenhua. She is the editor-in-chief of Truth Out and author of the, just released Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prisons Don't Work and How We Can Do Better. Welcome to the program, Maya.
Thanks so much, Sam.
So now, this is a very surprising book in some respects because the whole argument is really different, or in some ways, than we traditionally hear when we talk about prison reform. And prison reform is obviously and I think this audience is fairly familiar with the fact that prison reform is both on the left and the right is gaining more momentum. But you take this a step further. Just talk about how your perspective as an abolitionist differs from this sort of more, I guess, mainstream notion of reform.
Yeah. So it's true that definitely prison reform is kind of gaining steam, and especially around the war on drugs. There's a lot of energy to reduce prison budgets and to release people who are convicted of, say, like small-time drug possession. And that is becoming something that's more palatable to a lot of people. And what I bring up in the book, among a lot of other things, is that even though that's great, we also have to think about, in a larger sense, what prison is doing for and doing to society. And so that's not just about prison for the people convicted of drug possession. It's about prison for people convicted of pretty much anything. And that's, I think, in many ways, kind of a tricky step for a lot of people to take, because the very mentality of prison reform is, well, we need to incarcerate the right people. We need to incarcerate the people who deserve to be incarcerated. And what I talk about in my book is that incarceration actually doesn't work for anything that you're trying to address. It's not a tool that's actually useful for helping make society more safe.
Well, let's talk about, I want to break that down because there's a lot of stuff there, obviously. But what is ostensibly, it's sort of fascinating when you think about the how little we have progressed, I guess, as a society. Obviously, I think people are also familiar that we are the greatest mass incarcerator in the world relative, on a per capita basis.
Yep.
But it's amazing how we have not progressed in our sense of what the function of prison is supposed to be. I mean, what is the function of prison supposed to be in our society?
Well, I think that at least the stated goal is to protect the vast majority of people, the people who aren't in prison, from violence. And the idea is you're putting away kind of like the bad seeds or the bad apples in a place where they can't get the rest of us. And that is doing society a service because it's preventing violence, because the doers of violence, I guess you'd say, are behind bars. So that's kind of the logic. And then the other logic, which has been promoted a lot in recent years, is the idea of rehabilitation.
Right.
The idea that we are actually sending people to prison to be corrected. It's called a correctional system. And that through that, we are somehow bringing people out into a world where they will be productive citizens or participate in society in a way that is functional. And unfortunately, that's actually kind of the opposite of what prison does.
You know, it's also, I mean, I was struck as I was reading about this, it's sort of, it's also, you know, because I think on some level, that has always been, you know, and to the extent that I've thought about this, it's been, you know, it has not been, it's been fairly casual.
Mm-hmm.
When you start to contemplate this notion of like, it's supposed to be rehabilitative or that's almost like an add-on, right? Is the
right.
Icing. Because if you were to actually just set out like, we're going to have a system where we force people into a system where they're going to become better citizens.
Right.
And then you start to realize like, hey, that's sort of absurd, but let's talk about how it fails on both accords to some degree or does it?
Yeah. I think on both ends, it's failing. And you're right that the problem is it's premised on these false logics of what happens when you force someone into anything. So on the protection front, the idea is, well, we're taking the people out of society who are doing bad things. And that's kind of like the math there is really tricky because what the problem is actions, right? The problem is people being harmed. It's not that there are particular people who are inherently evil. And as long as we subtract them, then we're safe as a society. It's that there are forces in society, including poverty and homelessness and in some cases drug addiction and all of these forces that perpetuate crime and perpetuate harm in society. And as long as those things are around, people are still going to be stealing and people are still going to be committing survival crimes and getting into violence and all of these things. So taking out a few people isn't going to do the trick on that front. Then on the other side...
Well, wait a second. Before we get to the rehabilitation, let's stay there for a moment because the crime rate and particularly the violent crime rate in the entire country and I'm not sure internationally, although I think there's some there's data that suggests that's the case too, has gone down precipitously over the past 10, 15 years. Now there's different theories. I am one of those, and I think we've done a couple of shows on it. One of those people who's sort of like really intrigued by the lead theory, but to the extent that we don't know what has done that. How do you argue against that notion that, you know, okay, there are definitely forces that create a context in which someone inflicts harm on others, but there are people who might also be more susceptible to those contexts, and so we need to take them out of society and isolate them because we don't have the ability to address the context.
Right. And I think like part of the problem there is the way society frames mental illness and how we deal with mental illness in the society. If you're thinking about like, okay, certain people's brains are different and certain people's brains process poverty differently or whatever forces are there. So that's one issue. But I think that, A, in terms of the crime rate, there have been a couple of interesting studies lately that have talked about, well, what has accounted for this drop in crime? And no one's really come to anything conclusive. But what has been observed is that over the past 10 years and also over the past 5 years, the states that have seen the largest reductions in crime are the states that have also seen the largest reductions in incarceration. And so there is a sense, I think, in many ways, that even if you take out the other factors, prison is actually criminogenic. It's actually a force that encourages crime. And part of that is you send someone to prison and it's traumatizing. Caging a person in itself is traumatizing. And then also people go to prison and they experience violence, physical violence, sexual violence. They're in a situation with a lot of other people who've committed crimes. And so in some sense, they're learning crime skills. And also, they get out of prison and they have many fewer opportunities to earn money in legitimate ways.
Right.
And so there are all these factors. And another one, and this is one of the things that I concentrate on in the book, is that when you take someone out of society and isolate them and confine them, you're breaking down the ties that really would motivate them to change for the better in their life on the outside. You're breaking down their relationships with their families and their communities. And these are the things that really motivate improvement.
And you're breaking down any sort of like a potential notion of future relationships, right? I mean, who's going to marry me? I'm a ex-con. Or who's going to love me? Or how could I have a kid and have to explain to them that I was, that I was in jail? Or and I don't want to spend too much more time on just this one narrow aspect of it, but it really basically comes down to, unless you're prepared, I guess, to keep people in prison for their lives,
right?
For every conceivable crime, right? This is where it breaks down. Then I guess that's it. We're not prepared to do that. We don't have the resources. I think people would morally have a problem sending someone to jail for life for, I don't know, taking a joyride in a car or something.
Right.
But that's really the only way that we can avoid the implications of prison being essentially like graduate school for criminals.
Right. Well, and 95% of people who go to prison do get out. And then the vast majority of those people are rearrested within 3 years.
Wow.
So just even if you're just looking at basic numbers, this is not a functional system.
All right. So let's move on to the rehabilitative point. I mean, almost that recidivism rate statistic deals with that notion of rehabilitation. I mean, everything you're saying undercuts its effectiveness as being rehabilitative, I guess, if it's basically just encouraging more violence and crime.
Right. And it's this strange thing where we've tried all these things within prison. Like we've said, okay, we're going to incarcerate people, but while they're behind bars, we're going to give them all kinds of treatment. You know, we're just going to throw treatment at them. By the way, also spending a ton of money. But it turns out that when you put someone in a very difficult, violent, painful situation, cut them off from their family and everyone they know and make them feel terrible about themselves, and then you like put them in a counseling group, it's very difficult for them to get beyond like being counseled about the fact that they're in prison, you know?
Right.
You're keeping on more and more trauma as you're ostensibly trying to treat them. And the same goes for things like job training. Like that's another kind of key component of rehabilitation in prison, is this idea that like you're creating these programs that will train people up to get out and be really productive and contribute to the economy. But in reality, what you're doing is you're training people even in some federal prisons, they have like a whole array of training programs where you can learn a lot of different trades. You're training people in something that they won't be able to do when they get out because they won't have any opportunities. Because especially in an economy that's like really not that great, who's going to hire you coming out of prison? There was a study in New York recently that 70% of parolees were unemployed. So it's, you're really setting people up, training people up, supposedly rehabilitating people into nothing.
What about that program? I know that Bard College up in the Hudson Valley, they have some, they actually have, as far as I know, and only know about this casually as well, is that they have almost like, in the same way that universities or colleges will have like a satellite a campus, they have actually sort of like a like satellite programs in some New York state prisons. I don't know the efficacy of it, but again, that fits into that same model, right? Is it problematic for that same reason? In that,
yep, yeah, and I mean it's really. It's hard because prison exists right now, you know, so you don't want to like take all the programming out of the prisons that do exist. But I would argue that in a lot of these situations where you're trying to like teach people inside of prison, you know, send them to school inside of prison in an effort to have them like emerge into a field of opportunity, it would be a lot more effective to be able to fund them to go to school outside of prison. Actually, education is one of the predictors of not going to prison. You know, so if we were able to put some of the resources that we're funneling into prison actually into schools, so early childhood education is a really good example because that's one of the things that really supports people in making good decisions for the rest of their lives and is also a predictor of not going to prison in the future. So that's some place where we could put our resources and say, okay, like we're actually making an investment in public safety if we do this, as opposed to funding prison that has college in it.
Right. And in some way, there's a similar dynamic of what we see with the privatization of schools in
yeah.
that it is, instead of addressing what the root problem is here, it is sort of like it is using schools as a scapegoat for other societal ills that we don't want to deal with.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So it's like, well, you can sort of look at the school in a vacuum and say, oh, if we sold off these services or brought these companies in to do this, then we would solve something, as opposed to looking at all the root causes. Yeah. And actually, it's been like 3 decades that we've been using prison. We've been using mass incarceration as a band-aid for all of these different issues. And what I think is really interesting right now is as people start turning against the drug war, like now even the president is putting drug war in quotes, which I think is really nice, and saying maybe that didn't really work in fighting addiction or whatever we were trying to do. People are actually starting to come up against some of these questions and say, okay, if we don't use prison as a band-aid for homelessness or for mental illness or for poverty, then what do we actually do about it? And some of these prison reduction programs or decarceration programs, I think, are making kind of bad choices. Like a lot of the conservative choices are like, well, we should defund prisons and just put all that funding into police departments. You know, that's not something that I think would work.
Well, wait a second. Before we get into that, before we get into those, because I also want to make sure that we touch on the sort of the personal aspects of of this study. But also, do we have any sense of like where we are? Are there models internationally, before we start talking about sort of like some of the decarceration programs in this country and where we could go with reform, are there models internationally where some of these ideas are incorporated? I mean, how do we do? I know that we are the greatest mass incarcerator, but how do we do relative to things like recidivism or is there some model out there? And again, I've only casually looked at any of this, but is like Norway doing it the right way or Sweden or something?
They are. And
what are they doing?
What they're doing right is they're barely incarcerating anyone. I mean, they're just incarcerating many, many fewer people. And what they're putting funding into is healthcare and making sure that everyone has a house and things like that. And I think sometimes, like, when you talk about that, it seems like this lofty, like, future thing. Like, okay, well, maybe we can transition into, like, funding those things instead of funding prisons. But it actually is a real trade-off that if someone has a house, they're much more likely to avoid crime. And so that's one of the things that's happening. I'll also say, like, internationally, as the United States has gone the route of mass incarceration because of the drug war, that's in large part what's driven it. Other countries have dealt with drugs very differently. So the United States, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons behind mass incarceration. A huge one is racism and the particular kind of racism that operates here. But in other countries, the concept of drugs is dealt with much differently. And I think if you look at the fact that such a large percentage of the prison population here is there because of drugs, that's really instructive to look at. So, like, for example, in Vancouver, what they do, in addition to like a much broader range of legalization of drugs, is even a drug like heroin, where here, if you have heroin, you can go to prison for it. Like, it's like one of those drugs where it's still not friendly to Americans. Like, marijuana is kind of moving in the direction of being acceptable. So, but in Vancouver, the way that they're looking at heroin addiction is totally as a public health problem. So as a heroin addict, you are a person with an illness. You can make the choice to treat that illness or not treat it. And if you don't treat it, they're still going to support you in being healthy and leading as functional a life as possible. And they actually have these centers where they administer heroin to people who are dependent on it. So actually you have medical personnel standing there giving you heroin in very measured doses to satisfy your habit. And they're also giving you medical tests and information about treatment and all kinds of options for ways that you could change your life if you wanted to. And actually, that program has been tremendously successful, not only in getting people to go to treatment, like a lot more people go to treatment who've been through that program, but also in reducing crime. Because when people are able to be open about what they're doing and not kind of living in hiding and living on the street and trying to avoid the cops, they're a lot less likely to break the law.
And so they have actually seen like have they found a causal connection in terms of crime reduction in those programs?
Yeah, it's actually been pretty dramatic.
But we should also say that God probably doesn't like that, right? Because
Right. And that's really what they're struggling with at this point is God's disapproval.
You're not punishing the evildoers. And so God is very upset about that. All right, well,
God hates heroin.
And is very, like, not explicitly anti-Canadian, but is working his way there. And I do mean he. All right, so let's turn to the personal aspects of this story, because you've seen, I think, you know, a lot of, well, I'm curious, when you talk about the way that the prison system is dysfunctional and I can't recall the term you use, but it actually sort of criminalizes our society in some
right.
way. And you talk about the impact on the perpetrators, but also you talk about the impact on the victims and on their communities and on the sort of the context in which the perpetrator loses their connection or their drive, perhaps, to live a more sort of functional or positive life, I guess, in some ways. This came or did it precede your sister's series of incarcerations?
Well, they kind of came hand in hand. I was reporting on prison even before my sister first was incarcerated, but definitely her incarceration is what drove me to become more involved in reporting on this topic. And she's been in and out of prison for the past 9 years. And at first, when she went to jail, I thought it was a good thing. Because even though I was, you know, like a progressive and I thought mass incarceration is bad, I thought, well, she has a serious problem and prison seems like the thing that will solve it. Just I was buying into that logic. And her problem was addiction. And I thought, oh, well, you know, if we can just separate it from her drug of choice and from the people that she was interacting with around that drug on the outside, then, you know, she can kind of start over with a clean slate and everything will be great. And that's kind of the correctional model.
Right.
And that turned out to be completely false. She got out and went back into her life having, A, become addicted actually to a stronger drug while she was in jail that first time. And so the idea that jail keeps you away from drugs often is a myth. But also, the people that also had very low self-esteem, had been involved in crime for a long time, viewed themselves as worthless. All these things, the community that she became tied to was one in which people were cycling in and out of prison. And at the same time, she lost ties with all of her childhood friends. Many of my family members distanced themselves from her. And she emerged basically feeling like all she could be was a criminal.
Mm. And then she went on to actually have her child in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. And I think, you know, that story, it's somewhat obvious about how the dynamic that it perpetuates in terms of self-value and the perception of, to the extent that she has a future and whatnot. Hello? Oh, sorry. You're back.
You there?
Yeah, we lost you for a moment.
All right. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
So did you hear what I said about her having her child in prison?
Yes. Yes, I got that. And I was saying, so yeah, the last time she went to prison, she had her child behind bars. She was pregnant going in. And the pregnancy itself was pretty much unbearable, I think, both physically and psychologically. You think of pregnancy being this time kind of your sense of health and self-care is heightened. And when you're in prison, you can make no choices about what you do health-wise, but also you're not fed nutritious food. You're walking around in shackles. Your healthcare is very, very limited. And actually, my sister was so uneducated in the idea of what pregnancy was looking like that during one of our visits, she asked my mother, so how do I know, like, when I'm going to give birth? The doctor had not said anything to her about this. And basically the purpose of the doctor was to make sure that the fetus didn't die. Like, that would be a liability for them. But other than that, very hands-off. Then she actually ended up giving birth behind bars. And turned out she didn't have to know when she was giving birth because they didn't wait for her to go into labor. They actually scheduled the birth according to their schedule. And they woke her up at 4 a.m. one day and they said, okay, we're going. We're going to induce your labor. And so that was how this began. And she was in labor for 26 hours. No family was allowed, no friends, just one guard watching her the whole time as she was in labor. And when she gave birth, she was immediately shackled to the bedposts. She was able to remain with her child for a little over 24 hours. And after that, her daughter was taken from her, and she was taken away in handcuffs and taken back to prison.
Did your daughter, I mean, your sister, just for the sake of the audience, was she incarcerated for any violent crimes?
No, she was actually, and it's kind of amazing, this last time when she gave birth in prison and, you know, was shackled to the bedpost and they did everything they could to prevent her from being what they called a flight risk. She was actually incarcerated for stealing a bottle of perfume from the drugstore. So this is the level of crime that they put all that money and energy into incarcerating for. And previous to that, you know, she's a heroin addict. So it was all of these small drug offenses and a couple of thefts that she was arrested for, shoplifting. And so this time it was shoplifting.
And so what has happened to your niece?
So my niece was taken from the hospital. Fortunately, my mother was able to take her in for the time until my sister got out of prison. And that was a long few months because my niece was inconsolable. Like, babies cry a lot.
Right.
My niece never stopped crying, and she was the most difficult and obnoxious child I've ever met in my life. I love her very much. But, you know, her first experience was a major trauma. Her first experience was being uprooted and taken from her mother. And it really, I mean, you could see it playing out emotionally, even in this tiny child. And what happened for her was better than what happens for a lot of babies. Like, often the babies who are taken from their mothers in prison end up in foster care and never come out. And foster care is actually the major pipeline for prison. Most people in prison have been in foster care. But fortunately, in my niece's case, my sister got out in a few months and was able to be with my niece. And there was definitely a process of reintroduction. You know, they didn't know each other at first, and that was scary and depressing. But ultimately, they've become very close, and it's been a year since then. And my sister is a wonderful mother, but I just, the period of separation was really illuminating for me, just in seeing, wow, this is what the future could look like for a lot of other people. And certainly does.
And one could imagine, too, that if your sister didn't have the fortune of having your mom to take care of her child, this child goes into foster care. Your sister comes out of prison, perhaps without the resources in which to wage an extended legal case to try and get the child back. I mean, it's... it's clear, you know, where this leads.
Exactly.
All right, so let's talk about just briefly about some of those of how we, you know, what supplements or what would take place of prison in the case of drug offenses. You know, to a certain extent, you've articulated that in the model of Vancouver. But let's start at one end of the spectrum. I mean, I would imagine there is some percentage of prisoners who are some people who are incarcerated Maybe it's, you know, 1%, 2%, 0.05% who are sociopaths, who are,
right.
You know, serial killers, or, you know, are serial violent crime offenders.
Right.
What do we do with those? Let's start there, because that's the most difficult, I guess, question.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think that one thing to keep in mind when we're talking about decarceration is that those are the last people who are going to be decarcerated. Like, we're definitely not going to be flinging the doors to prison open tomorrow for the people who are incarcerated for multiple murders. So we have a little while to think about it.
Right.
But definitely one thing to keep in mind is everyone has images in their heads of the serial killer. Like, these are the people we need to keep in prison. But the people that we're picturing, you can pretty much count on one hand.
Well,
you know?
Right. I mean, that's sort of the dilemma, though, right? When you talk about being an abolitionist of prison, the first thing that people think about as to why that idea is crazy in their mind is because of that 0.0003% of the prison population.
Right, exactly. And I think that in that sense, abolition is really kind of a call to develop something new. Like, I think for almost everyone in prison, we can say, okay, here are some options for what we could do differently to address harm and violence. I think that in terms of, like, real sociopaths and in terms of that tiny, tiny percentage, one thing we have to think about is, how do we deal with mental health? How do we deal with, you know, people who, when they're 3 years old, are being chronically abused and neglected and not taken care of in terms of their health problems? And kind of starting there, as opposed to looking at the 35-year-old person who's killed 10 people. So I think that's one way to frame it. Another way to frame it is, I think, thinking about, well, how can we prevent violence in the future, and how can we promote healing for victims? And both of those things, prison doesn't actually work. So because of recidivism and because prison is traumatizing and violent, you can't use prison as a way of preventing violence, even for the person who's doing violence. And in terms of victims healing, someone going to prison doesn't directly kind of solve any of the problems that victims are going through. Counseling isn't even provided to victims in the court. But what is provided is, like, this ongoing, endless trial in which they need to re-experience their trauma again and again and again. So I think that, like, instead of having kind of a ready-made solution for what to do with that 0.003%, we should start thinking about just, like, the framework in which we deal with violence. And also, what is really the problem here? Well, the problem is that people have been killed and that they have family members grieving and mourning whose lives have been destroyed. So I think one way to reframe it is, what can we do for them? How can we invest resources in helping them? And maybe, you know, in 100 years, when we decide that we need to, like, burn down that last cell block and release those 5 serial killers, you know, we'll have a better sense of how society could use its resources better in regard to them.
And when you talk about that, addressing the harm, you're talking about restorative justice model, right? Will you just explain that?
Yeah, I think in some ways that's a model that works. And in that model, really the victim's concerns and the way that the victim has been harmed, those concerns are centered. And so oftentimes what happens is the victim is brought together with their community and with people who are important to them, with the perpetrator, the person who has caused them harm, and they sit together and both sides tell their stories, what happened that prompted this act and how did this act affect the victim. and the perpetrator has to listen to that. Often perspectives change even throughout that process. But very often the goal is to come to sort of an accountability agreement. And that agreement is based on what the victim needs to heal. And so that could be all kinds of things depending on the situation. So there's a town in Montana where they do this restorative justice process for all youth offenders, as long as the victim agrees, and the victim almost always agrees. So for example, if a youth breaks into a house and steals a television and is then brought together in the circle with the victim's family, their family, they all talk about, okay, how did this crime actually affect the victim's family? Well, maybe in addition to the property damage and the stolen television, it also really scared the children. Now the children can't sleep at night. Maybe the parents have had to miss work and stay home and deal with it. It's psychologically changed the way the family operates. All of these things that maybe the person breaking in wouldn't have even thought about. And then when the victim is asked, well, what do you need from this person who you've now gotten to know in order to heal and feel like maybe they are less likely to do this thing again? So maybe in the case of the television, the youth would have to earn back the money that would pay for a new television. The youth might have to do the repairs on the house, learn how to do the repairs to replace the window and anything else that damaged the house. The youth might have to enroll in a counseling program to help prevent future crime. And also, oftentimes, what they do is they need to give updates to the victim or the victim's family, regular updates saying, this is what I'm doing to prevent future harm of this kind. And oftentimes there have been cases, and this is like pretty common in this community in Montana, where the victims actually become mentors to the offenders because they develop these close bonds through sitting in circle with them and through getting all these reparations from them as accountability for their crimes.
And I would imagine the reparations don't just like heal, okay, you fix the door you broke down, but it actually sort of replaces the trust that the family can have in their own security in some way, just that they can see that, you know, this person somehow psychologically watching this person rehabilitate themselves or make up or provide reparations somehow heals some of that loss of security.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it also kind of restores a certain sense of faith in their community, that their community is watching. Everyone knows this is going on. There's been this circle. And so the offender is accountable not only to them as the victims, but also to all the community members who've gone into this process.
From a data perspective, how has that worked out in Montana, which I assume is probably not a, you know, I mean, I'm curious as to how it took root in Montana, which I don't perceive as a hippy dippy, you know, this is not.
Yeah, well, this is like a majority Republican community, actually. They're like very conservative. And the way it came about was there was a restorative justice program operating in this community, but it wasn't actually connected with the police department in any way. But one year, I think it was 4 years ago, the recidivism numbers came in for juvenile offenders in Montana, and this county, Flathead County, had the worst recidivism in the state. And so the town kind of like came together and said, wow, like our recidivism rates are so bad and we're spending so much money was kind of crucial, spending so much money on incarcerating children, and it's not working out very well. So like, what do we do? And restorative justice was one of the approaches that was on the table because this program existed like at a community level. So they decided to try it, and the results were really dramatic. Wow. They reduced recidivism, like, so quickly over the course of, like, 4 years. And now they have one of the lowest juvenile recidivism rates in the state. And so this process has really fundamentally changed the way people think about justice in this community. And it started just really by thinking about money.
Well, that's what's really funny, because a big part of your argument is that we've got to stop differentiating between the sort of the good prisoner and the bad prisoner, and that, right. We've got to take God's morality out of the question. Like, they've done something wrong. They must be punished.
Right.
The problem is that the thinking about it in terms of just practicality still sort of like cuts against that or feeds right. into that notion. But it's still, I guess, ultimately it is the I guess that's the low hanging fruit, right? Is to say that this is going to save us money. And then it becomes easier.
I mean, honestly, I think that you can make a really pragmatic argument, even if you have no empathy whatsoever for any human being. You can just make the argument that if you look at recidivism rates and if you look at what prison does to people, it's actually not an effective way of maintaining public safety for anyone. And so if, you have that real pragmatic mindset, you want to look for alternatives that are going to foster a fundamentally different society where you don't have these cycles of crime. And so I hesitate to say that it could be a conservative argument, because I think that, like, the conservative argument really is laced with all kinds of, like, racist undercurrents, that no matter what you say and no matter how good of an idea it is, there's something that needs to come back to incarcerating Black people. But I think just from, like, almost an objective standpoint, it does make sense to turn away from incarceration, because it's not actually a solution for anything.
Maya Shenhwar, Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prisons Don't Work and How We Can Do Better. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, folks. It's time for we went a little long on that one. Fascinating stuff. An amazing sort of confluence between her personal, life, I guess, with her sister and the reporting that she was already doing. Again, we will link to that on our site. Folks, you know the drill. Become a member, blah, blah, blah. We're going to try and launch. And I say try because you know how it is around here. We just barely – yesterday I managed to just get the cables sorted out. Did you see this, Michael? You didn't see this because you skedaddled so quickly. You see how clean the cables are now? Do folks notice there's no buzzing?
I was here till about 4:30.
I don't think so.
4:30 what? In Heathrow time.
Oh, wait. No, I confused myself. No, I was at Greenwich Mean Time. I was gone by 3:30, but I went to the gym, and then I came back later.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I mean, of course.
And I did notice how clean it was.
Yeah.
Good job.
All right.
You know what I kept thinking of?
No.
I thought of during that interview, and it's terrible to even bring this up, but Richard Pryor did a routine once where he went to a prison to research a role, and he kind of did a whole thing about how he went in, obviously, with the notion of racism in the criminal justice system and, and he's talking to a guy, an inmate, and the guy was there for doing a home invasion where he killed every single member of the family who was there. And Richard Pryor was like, well, I mean, he's trying to get to the guy's brain. He's like, so you couldn't have just like tied him up and blindfolded him? Like, what? Why did you have to kill everybody? And the guy was like, because they were there. And Richard Pryor's like, he's like, I left and I was like, lock him up. Like he became, but that illustrates it, like what you were saying, how this little tiny
well, that's
fraction,
the first thing that people
that's the first thing people, and the other thing that occurred to me was I was just like chronicling all these things that I did as a teenager, all, you know, none of which in and of themselves were like that exceptional, but if you start to calculate and you realize people in certain communities in certain situations, a drug conviction here, shoplifting there, you get serious devastating.
We've been down this road with you too, haven't we? Oh. And we don't really know the full details because you were like
I'm a little elusive about that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to share red. Publicly Look the worst it. Thing that I did, but I never did anything. The point is I didn't do anything that bad, but I just think if you –
Well, yes.
You accumulate –
there's a little bit more – there's more margin for error if you're coming from
right.
Your socio background.
Right. And you hear about stories in three strike states where it really is like, yep. you know, the 30-year sentence for stealing a shirt.
You steal a bottle of perfume and you subject your unborn child to a trial. And I can hear the conservative voices right now. Well, it's her fault. She's got to take responsibility for it. But, you know, the baby. But it really is. There's so much just caught up in this notion. I don't know why I keep hearing Indie Mike's voice in my head.
It's also just,
but it is a process style argument, right? If you know that the point that theoretically we all agree the reason why we have prisons, I'm just stipulating it. The reason why we have prisons is because we want to sequester people who could do us harm. And to the extent that any of those can actually be reintroduced to society, we want to teach them, don't commit a crime again. And that could either be like, we're going to teach you not to commit a crime again because you're going to get sent back here. And that's going to be the stick. And maybe we give them a couple of carrots. If I'm feeling really, you know, liberal, we're going to let them learn to read or whatever it is. Right? That's the carrot. Right. And even in light of data that, like, look, it's not achieving either one of those things. It is not sequestering the people who could do harm because eventually most of them get out, the vast majority of them get out. And because you've just trained them to basically do more harm, they're going to do more harm. We can see that through the recidivism rate. And it also, you know, it's not just the carrot and the stick. Neither one of those work. Even faced with that, it's just like, well, but morally speaking, they have to pay a price.
It's ridiculous. But look, I mean, what give people the opportunity to take responsibility? That whole explanation of restorative justice sounds to me like taking more responsibility than anything else.
Definitely.
And that works better for everyone in every
possible
way.
You start to wonder, you know, that dynamic that I just talked about, well, even though prison's not working, like even if they could get to the point where, and Indie Mike would say, and I don't know why I'm obsessing about Indie Mike about this.
Because you're obsessed with him.
Yes. He would say, well, you've got your data, and then I've got other data that I'm not going to cite.
Your data,
but that
my data.
Right. But that dynamic of, well, we're a country of laws, and if you break the law, you must be punished, is also sort of like, you know, you see that in the undocumented immigrant debate. And even though it's not really actually a crime, it is a civil violation to come into this country without documentation or to overstay your visa. It's a civil, you know, like a speeding ticket. It's just you start to really start to get the sense of where race and otherness plays into this. And if we got to throw a couple of white guys in there to justify having this entire prison, we'll do that too. Whatever. Folks, speaking of data, when we get around Christmas time, we haven't quite figured it out yet, but it could be a little bit extended because Christmas falls in the middle of the week and New Year's falls like towards the last third of the week. So we could be off for like 7 days, 7 business days. And although it's quite possible since Michael's taking his vacation early, Michael will be here. I don't know what you'll be
down
doing.
The fort myself. Yeah,
exactly.
All right.
Michael will be doing a lot of like office work. Oh. Come back and have painted an intricate mural on the wall. What we need from you, folks.
You and Indy Mike, an illustrated story.
What we need from you is your suggestions for best ofs. Now, freebie people will be able to give best ofs for interviews and this and that. Members will be able to give best ofs for segments or phone calls or this and that, whatever. Send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in the words best of so that we can search it. Because we get a lot of emails, so it makes it easier for us. So words best of, and we will take your suggestions and construct some best ofs of the year 2014. And if it's really close, like at the end of the year 2013, last year, we could do that too. All right? But, and yes, Walter Block already there. We may do a week of Walter Block.
Yeah. A block of Walter Block.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to head into the...
A block block.
Now, why... What do you... Why, what's that?
Oh, it had nothing to do with that. It was something I saw on my computer.
We've got a audio and video of a guy in Pontiac, Michigan getting stopped by the cops, or a cop. I guess a sheriff. And... it's a fascinating exchange because it really does show just how effed up things are in terms of the criminalization of black people in this country. All right, we got to take a break. We'll play that, and we've got other stories, obviously, in the funner half. Number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the show. What you do is you simply call, and then we answer the phone. And that's the way it generally works. 646-257-3920. If you're holding right now, we will get to your calls in a moment. You can IM the show via our app at majorityapp.com. Totally free. Totally free. Or you can IM us at majorityfm. See you in the funner half.